McCurdy. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this case and recused from the rest of the cases of the day. With that in mind, then, Mr. Cordes, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Honorable members of this court, those counsel, may it please the court. I represent Michael McCurdy, and this case is before you on a petition for further review. We are challenging the convictions and sentences of five counts. Three counts of first-degree sexual assault of a child, one count of first-degree sexual assault under 319A and B, and a child abuse count. I believe, my best guess, is that petition for further review was granted in respect to the allegation that went to count three, which is a first-degree sexual assault under 28319A and B, and it was for the purpose, I believe, to address whether or not the decision in In Re KM, which is a juvenile case, has any application or needs to be modified, if so, for the application into the adult world of criminal convictions. And so I want to begin with the standard of review, and I have in mind a particular case that I think is most appropriate to name the standard of review, and I want to bring that up because there was a different standard of review in KM because it was a juvenile case. And I want to begin in January with a Judge Stacy decision, Lewison versus Renner. It's 298 Nebraska 654, and it was just a tort case involving a car accident where one person conceded they were at fault, but a general verdict was awarded for the defendant, and the injuries included mental and physical pain and suffering. And Your Honor, you stated that when the character of an alleged injury is subjective rather than objective, the plaintiff must establish the extent of the injury through medical expert testimony. And you explain that possibility or speculation is not enough. You need reasonable medical certainty or reasonable probability. And when you did that, you had a footnote. You had two footnotes, but it was the same case. Doe versus Zedek, which is a 1999 case, which only Justice Miller-Lerman was on during that time. But it's an important case as well, because that was a case where the patient was sexually assaulted in a mental health hospital, and then it was charged that the treating physician didn't respond appropriately to that sexual assault. And in that
case, civil tort case?
Civil tort case.
Okay.
And in that case, it involved mental suffering and a sense of helplessness. And this court ruled, just like you, that mental suffering and sense of helplessness are the type of injuries that are demonstrated by just a complaint to victims. They're subjective. And those need to be established by medical testimony. And it explained that you need to do that to weed out whether or not other factors could have caused those symptoms or complaints to manifest itself. And it's the type of injury for which you need experts, type of injury for which possible is not enough. Okay, now we get to a criminal case. We take that Zoe versus Zodek case, and we find State versus Murrow in 2005. It's 269 Nebraska 703. And that, Your Honors, I believe the case most applicable to us when we determine what is the standard of review. Now, the standard of review is your usual standard of review for sufficiency of the evidence. You have a proof beyond a reasonable doubt, light seen in the most light favorable to the state, and you ask whether or not an element was not established. And in that case, we had child abuse resulting in death. We had a mother who came upon a child that had been struck in the head or had an injury caused by somebody else. She gets the child at 7, doesn't bring that child in until 11, so we have 4-hour delay. Child dies, and the question is whether or not that delay caused the child's death. Okay? That conviction was reversed, and it was reversed on the basis that there was insufficient evidence established that this injury was caused probably or within the threshold of the necessary medical evidence.
Did the accused rule wiggle its way into that analysis?
The accused rule. I'm not sure what you mean by the accused rule. Your Honor?
It's an interpretation of circumstantial evidence that keeps wiggling its way back into our jurisprudence. And when we recognize it, we refute it, and then it wiggles its way back into our jurisprudence again.
Okay. Your Honor, honestly, I still don't
know
what you mean. But I do know this.
State v. Pierce is probably the seminal citation about that, if that rings a bell.
The wiggle room?
Yes.
What I want to say about this case Is it likened its application of you need medical testimony to establish something that was beyond possible, but it was probable and a medical certainty? Okay. And because that was lacking in that case, I didn't have a doctor come in and say that that child would have lived had this misconduct on the part of the defendant not occurred. Okay. And when it did that, Your Honor, it said, we're going to look at workers' comp cases. We're going to look at malpractice cases. And we know those standards are out there. But this is a criminal case where the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, and our threshold should be at least that, if not higher. And that is the very substance of the dissenting opinion in the Court of Appeals case below that by Judge Sievers, where he was arguing, hey, you know, you shouldn't have for these legal tort claims a lower standard that meets the burden than you do for the state.
Let me back up here. You're focused on the first degree sexual assault.
Yes.
And the manner of which the conviction would be under 28.3191B, that the defendant knew or should have known the victim was mentally or physically incapable of resisting. That's the pigeonhole your discussion pertains to. Is that right?
Your Honor, for that conviction, it can be accomplished under two means. Under A, it's without consent, and under B, we get to the mental capacity to...
So let me catch up here.
Yeah.
So your proposition that expert testimony would be helpful or necessary, are you saying, and that would also be true with respect to 1A, without the consent of the victim?
My argument on that, Your Honor, is what the court did is it looked to the language, we have a person that has not... that has consented to the sexual activity of the 16 and 17-year-old, but in the past had been victimized by the person that she consented to as 16 and 17-year-old. And the question was whether or not that condition in the past made it futile to resist in the past and how to deal with it. The problem with this is under the first prong of 319A, which not consent comes into play, you have a statutory definition for not consent. And that is a statutory definition that the Court of Appeals used with the resistance would be futile. But to get to that resistance to be futile, you have to go through the whole set of definition schemes, go through A, B,
well, let
C,
me,
and
let me
then
back
D.
up yet again. So under the first degree statute that we're looking at, right, if there were a set of facts that proved without consent, that would be what you are urging, or if there were a set of facts that proved mentally or physically incapable, right, that would achieve the same result you see, or victim is of certain ages and that's not relevant to this particular count, correct? This is the count with the victim over 16 or over.
I can break it down more simply, Your Honor. Without the consent of the victim is 3191A, and it can't be that, Your Honor, because the victim consented. And because the victim consented, you don't even get to the D prong of the definition of without consent, because when a person consents, then you only go to whether or not there was deception that caused that dissent. And then when you get to the fact that there was without consent, that there was consent, then you're no longer under a 1A, and you have to go into a 1B.
The jury was charged with the definition of both, though, without consent or mentally unable.
My problem
so we don't, and they could have come out voting for different A or B, but as long as they all came out with A or B, they had unanimous verdict, right?
The Court of Appeals, to deal with the sufficiency of the evidence argument, applied that D language from without consent inappropriately, because you don't get to that because there was consent. The only way you could have got to a lack of capacity to resist would have had to have gone to the B language, whether or not there is a mental impairment that was so severe as to deprive a person or lack of capacity. And I want to get to that, Your Honor, because you deal with cases that deal with a lack of capacity, and you cite the cases where you need an expert. And those expert cases are all, every one of them that you cited, all deal with whether or not a person knew what sex was and knew what the consequences of sex could be if you had it. You go to the Alaska case, you have a 26-year-old, low IQ of the 50, didn't know what birth control was, couldn't answer with any more than a few words. The Summers case, you have a 44-year-old, mental health facility resident, didn't know anything about sexually transmitted disease, thought babies came from stomachs, and alleged that the defendant put his tail inside her. In the Kansas case, you have somebody that was at the developmental age of 4 to 6 years old. In the Fuentes case, you had a developmentally disabled person that was deaf and lacked the capacity to sign language with other than broken sign language. So
let me ask you something. What do you think the Court of Appeals decided? In a nutshell, what was the decision based on? Futility?
They decided wrong. They just misapplied the futility language from the no consent definition.
The definitions under 318.
And they brought it into play into a mentally disabled definition under the B. And for that kind of situation, this is a situation where you needed experts. And the cases that you cite when you don't need experts are all that severe, where you have somebody who is so mentally disabled that it's obvious is listening to him testify. In every one of those cases, there was an independent person testifying as to their abilities, and they all were unable to appreciate what sex was or what the consequences were. Nothing like this case. We have somebody who consented to sex, college graduate, perfectly aware of what the consequences was, had a child with this baby, knew that, you know, that was a consequence. So it was nothing like that. So it didn't merit this resistance to futile language, because that would have only been appropriate if you applied the progression of the definition of without consent appropriately, which wasn't...
Because that's found in the neighborhood of without consent in the statutes.
Right. And then when you get to B, non-consent is not an element of the offense. You don't even get there. What you get to is whether or not the person is so physically disabled that they lack the capacity to understand the nature and consequences of sex. And so they couldn't be a consensual participant in the activity. I see that I am out of time. Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Ralph, good morning to you.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. We're here on McCurdy's petition for further review. It seems to focus on the sufficiency, so I will too. I meant to print off the exact statutes this morning, and I spaced it out, so I did not. But my understanding of the Court of Appeals opinion, to address your question, Justice Miller-Lerman, was that they decided under 28.3191A, which is without consent, that there was sufficient evidence for a rational trier fact to say she resisted in the years from when he first started sexually assaulting her, from when she was 9 or 10 years old, through the duration up to when she turned 16. And it never worked. And so because it never worked, it was resistance was futile, was unavailing, and it fell within that definition without consent under 28.3188. So...
Well, that was the import of one of my question. Which pigeonhole did you think ultimately was the basis for the Court of Appeals opinion?
That was the basis for the Court of Appeals opinion. They
that
never
it was
reached...
It was a 319A without consent type of action.
Yes. And I think the evidence was sufficient for them to go that route, an alternative route to the 319B. And so that issue that, you know, he raised in brief basically about Collins and that KM case that you guys, or Your Honors came out with, I don't think is really at issue here in this opinion maybe.
But that is the question presented on further review.
Well, it was
as I recall, assignment of error that the Court of Appeals failed to say encompassing things about mental disability and so forth.
Yes, that was the one of the four assigned errors in the PFR, basically that the Court of Appeals failed to address his contention in brief. But I don't think that it really is an issue worthy of further review because they went the alternative route and said the evidence was sufficient under the without consent prong. And so whether it was sufficient under A or B, the jury was presented with both. The verdict is the verdict, and the evidence was sufficient under that alternative prong rather than subsection B.
Well, you don't have your copies of the statutes in front of you, as you can see, but maybe you can still do this from memory. Is futility a species of without consent, or within that statute, is it merely a narrative of or informs the other manners of without consent?
Well, no, I think it was a species of without consent, and that's how the Court of Appeals, you know, took it as well. 28.318(c), a victim need not resist verbally or physically, or it would be useless or futile to do so. And I think that's the language that the Court of Appeals emphasized, said that the evidence was sufficient to support that, and so it was also sufficient to say she was sexually penetrated without her consent.
So your understanding of the statute is that the without consent feature of 318(8), there's a lot of manners mm-hmm. of without consent. One of them would be futility. Is that,
yes,
is that what you're urging?
Yes.
Okay.
And unless this court has any further questions on the remaining assigned errors in the petition, we would submit that the Court of Appeals' disposition of those was correct, and we'd ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
What's your response to the argument made this morning with respect to the need for expert testimony on, as I understood the argument, we might not have let counsel get all the way to the end of it, but as I understood what he was suggesting, there may be, he was advocating for the need for expert testimony to allow the finders of fact to determine whether a victim who's abused, sexually abused chronically, mm-hmm. four times a week for many, many years, whether there's an impact on the verbal and physical resistance.
I don't think a per se rule for expert testimony being required is necessary. I think this court in In Re KM, as well as the Court of Appeals in State v. Collins, indicated that when analyzing subsection B, their capacity to consent, basically, that sure, expert testimony might be useful in certain situations, but a per se rule doesn't make sense, that it's a case-by-case analysis, and that where, you know, the evidence essentially, under sort of a common sense type analysis, can be said to indicate that the victim didn't have a capacity to consent, that might be sufficient. So I don't think a per se an expert testimony requirement is sensible.
Do you think the rule as it was framed, or the principle of law as it was framed in KM, is satisfactory to address this?
I don't know that I would say that, primarily because it seemed like the KM opinion really emphasized a mental impairment. And I'm not sure why youth or being of a young age would not also play into the incapacity to consent or the lack of capacity to consent to sexual contact. So I don't know that, and I just briefly read KM, but I don't know that I would say that it covers all scenarios.
Thank you.
Let me go back to the 318(8). Without consent definition,
uh-huh.
And the statute reads, without consent means A1, the victim was compelled to submit due to the use of force or threat of force or coercion.
Mm-hmm.
Does the state have a position on the meaning of coercion as a type of without consent? Must it be physicality, or could it be the result of a psychological pattern?
Oh, I think it could definitely be part of a psychological pattern. Coercion, I think in many instances, is not physical. It's a mental attack, I guess, on the victim. So I don't think it would be limited to threat of force or physical force.
Which are different phrases within that.
Yes, okay. Which would also indicate that, you know, different situations are encompassed within that language. Unless there are further questions, we'd ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Our next